agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good afternoon, Mike.
Yeah, good afternoon. How are you doing this week, Jay? Today, this afternoon,
well,
whatever.
I feel more confident than a Hillary Clinton lawyer in front of a D.C. jury.
Oh, very good. Very good. And that's a very nice kind of intro, at least a little bit later on in the show. We are going to be talking about that Sussman acquittal, and also as well a bunch of other things. Russia and Ukraine, we're now at the 100-day mark. The Supreme Court and its ruling on emergency ruling on a Texas social media law, the Tulsa shooting, and a little bit kind of a different take on the whole gun thing. And yes, we too will be talking about the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, but in a very different way, I'd like to think, and certainly, Jay, at a higher plane than TMZ or what have you, I would hope. You know, so
we'll see
exactly.
How it plays out.
That and perhaps more, we will see. But anyway, we're going to get to all of that in just one second. Okay, so Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which of course the gangster Putin expected to be relatively quick and easy, it's now reached the 100-day mark, thanks to fierce resistance by the Ukrainians first and foremost, but also strong support from Ukraine's allies and a fair amount of Russian military incompetence. But despite that incompetence, Russia has managed to gain a significant amount of territory in Ukraine, around 20% or so by some estimates, and that's up from 7% before this latest Russian aggression against Ukraine began 100 days ago. But those gains, of course, have come at a tremendous cost. By some estimates, over 30,000 deaths, many more wounded, millions and millions of refugees, totally shattering economic consequences, and really pretty grisly and growing record of Russian war crimes. Now, to this point, the United States has allocated around $54 billion in total aid to Ukraine, and most people think that there will almost certain to be another request before the end of the year from the Biden administration. If we pull back and look at total aid to Ukraine, well, total military aid, somewhere around $33 billion, with the U.S. providing around 80% of that, including in this most recent round of aid this week, advanced longer-range rocket systems, which, at least in the configuration supplied to Ukraine, will have a maximum range of somewhere around 40 miles, which is double that of the best current artillery Ukraine has access to. Now, according to William Albuquerque, who's a director of strategy, technology, and arms control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, what we're now seeing is in his words, a combination of artillery barrage, airstrikes, and missile strikes that's grinding the Ukrainians down. On the economic front, early this week, the EU agreed to a sixth round of sanctions against Russia. And in this round, it bans sea-delivered crude oil from Russia in 6 months and then refined petroleum products 2 months later. After some pretty strong resistance from Russia, not exactly friends, certainly, but Hungary, pipeline oil deliveries were exempted from that ban. The EU has also blocked insurers from covering Russian oil cargoes. Now, while this deal will deal even more of a blow to Russia's fossil fuel-dependent economy, at least over time, it certainly comes at a significant cost to the EU, which still, of course, relies heavily on Russian energy, as well as a pretty big cost to the world economy. So, Jay, that's an awful lot, but it's been a pretty hectic and tragic 100 days. So let me start with a big question. At this point, are you feeling, I don't know, optimistic, pessimistic, somewhere in between?
Certainly more optimistic than I was when this began, 6 weeks ago. The general consensus, and I certainly just kind of fell in and followed blindly the general consensus, was that Russia would just kind of waltz into Ukraine and this would be all over in a week or two. much as the you know, Crimean annexation that happened back in 2014. Yeah. So, and on the one hand, I'm glad I was wrong. On the other hand, there was this sense, I think, in the West, you know, I guess to our shame to some extent, that, you know, all right, yeah, he'll go in, he'll take it, it'll be done and over. And then the hard decisions for us are over. We can sort of gripe about the Russians doing this and so forth. But, well, it's done, and what you're going to do now? But the Ukrainian resistance has changed that equation and you know, made it possible that it looks like the Ukrainians could, if not win, again, continue to extract a heavy price. Now, the concern that I think that we're hitting right now is this is, you know, a war of attrition, and the Russians do have more people, more material to throw at this than what the Ukrainians do, despite our continuing providing of weapons and equipment. So the West has to keep up its resolve on this. And Putin has become an international pariah. His strategic goal of keeping NATO farther away from Russia seems to have backfired.
Yeah.
With the Nordic countries seeking membership. And I think that in some ways it's what he's done is sort of revitalized NATO and the West, which again is not the what he was looking for. Now, the fact that Putin hasn't realized all his strategic goals isn't necessarily good news for the Ukrainians who he's going to be taking this out on. But it, you know, in the bigger picture, I'm happy that the West has stood up as well as it has, and NATO nations have. I expected more of a kind of rolling over and sort of an accepting of, well, it's inevitable they're going to take over, but what you're going to do. So, in that sense, I have reason to be optimistic. In terms of, you know, the situation on the ground, you know, no, this is going to continue to drag on, and there's going to be continued atrocities and war crimes, and displacement and refugees and all the horrors that go with war. So I'm pessimistic on that side, right? The longer a war lasts, but
and even more to that point, Jay, even more than that, the Russian strategy, so to speak, of basically just almost indiscriminately bombing civilian targets, non-civilian targets, pretty much anything to reduce it to rubble before trying to go in. That's just, so that's more than just, you know, well, war's hell. This is
This is, and this is really, I wouldn't say unique, but certainly an outlier, right, in terms of the way wars have been fought. This is almost a state-sponsored terrorism type campaign, right? Where we're deliberately targeting civilians.
Yeah.
And this is not abiding by any, you know, rules of war or principles, or even sort of the common sense thing of we're going to attack military targets or strategic targets.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing you mentioned is the resolve and the unity of Ukraine's allies. And just like you, I have been impressed, and I'm glad I was wrong about the extent of that. Right. But we are starting to see at least what could be the beginnings of sort of a splintering of that, with sort of, if you want to break it down to sides, Germany and France seem to be much more eager for some sort of a brokered peace that might involve Ukraine permanently giving up more of its rightful territory on one end. And then you have the US, the UK, and those former Soviet republics who are basically saying, no, this is not something we want to do at all. And it probably won't surprise any listeners on the show that both you and I are definitely squarely on the side here of the US, the UK, and those former Soviet republics. And I will speak for you on that. I'm pretty sure on that issue. But that's my concern. Not only that, but even in Congress, we're starting to hear both from, you know, the left and even more from the right about how, well, what are we doing here and what's our commitment going to be? There was a big opinion piece by Josh Hawley in a new sort of a paleocon, some kind of con, periodical that just came out about why are we nation building in Ukraine? Let's forget about the fact that we're not actually doing that.
This has nothing to do with nation building.
But the point being is that there is a prominent faction certainly within the GOP that has major problems with this. And the more we put into this, the more I think powerful that faction grows, especially given the fact that this has just been really difficult economically.
Yeah, we'll see on that. I don't know how much the economic piece is really resonating with Americans, in that, you know, they're blaming the inflation that we have and gas prices and so forth on Putin and the war. I think there's some of that, but I think most people realize, you know, gas prices were going up beforehand. And look, that's a problem that is fixable. Maybe not in the immediate short term, but it's fixable in the medium term.
Yeah.
In terms of bringing online more capacity, and just recently, for example, decisions of OPEC nations to increase production. So I think that's, you know, that's not going to bring down gas prices tremendously this summer, but it.
Which is the last thing Republicans would want. Some Republicans would want, right? At least those running for office.
Yeah, but,
Yeah. But, you know, and it was interesting in that op-ed. It sort of made me cringe because Ali suggested that Republicans need to be more like Teddy Roosevelt nationalists as opposed to Woodrow Wilson internationalists. And the fact that Ali was aligning himself with, you know, one of my heroes and idols, Teddy Roosevelt, made me cringe in 37 different ways.
Yeah, where was San Juan Hill exactly?
You know, I
don't believe it was the continental United States. But
the logic in the article was, shall we say, somewhat less than entirely rigorous. How about that? But seriously, that is obviously a concern, especially because I am of the mind that anything but sort of a total, complete, unquestioned defeat for Putin sends a message that this sort of thing, if done smartly enough, you know, unprovoked aggression, hey, it has its benefits. And I just think that's not a message we can afford to send, especially when China is eyeing Taiwan and has been for quite a number of, well, generations now at this point. And so, you know, that brings me to Biden's so-called slip up on Taiwan. I don't know if it was or not, but, you know, several weeks ago, a reporter asks him, are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that? And Biden responds, yes, that's the commitment we made. Now that's technically not the commitment we made exactly. And the White House kind of walked that back, saying, well, Biden did say we agree with the one China policy and so forth. But I actually think maybe this is a time to have less strategic ambiguity about Taiwan and just in general about how we're going to deal with unprovoked aggression.
Oh, I agree.
So
Gosh, it's like Mike from 1991 has time traveled.
Well,
with us today.
Well, this is one of these areas, though, where I mean, I've changed in a lot of ways, but on this, maybe not so much, you know, certainly. So, so anyway, we are definitely of one mind on this more than perhaps almost any other issue I can think of that we talk about.
I think so. And look, this is, I'm not saying that, and I think there are good times, and it's smart to question when we need to intervene in international affairs, right? The answer shouldn't be an automatic yes all the time.
Sure.
But in these types of situations, we do have a national interest, I think, in preserving the world order. And I know that's a weird, goofy way to say it, but you know, I think you and I have both talked about this a number of times. That we may not want to be the world's policeman, but you know, the choices are having no police or having the Chinese or
power
abhors
the vacuum.
Like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's definitely. And you know, I also agree with the congressional Republicans and actually some of the liberals like Senator Elizabeth Warren, who say, listen, the DOD has not been doing a great job of being accountable for this equipment and this money. And we want them to start giving us this information and giving us reports about what's going where and how you're keeping track of it. And apparently there's a very long backlog. And when we're talking about, you know, what's probably in the end, I'm guessing, I'm hoping really is going to be, you know, north of $100 billion. Well, then, yeah, we better know where that's going and how we're accounting for it, especially when we're starting to get into more advanced weapon systems that, you know, there's certainly a potential for them to fall into the wrong hands. And when we're talking about aid, let's remember Ukraine is our ally and Ukraine is a democracy, but Ukraine is also, you know, there is a fair amount of corruption there.
Yeah.
And so I think those concerns are absolutely well-founded.
No, I agree with you there. And I don't think that it's inconsistent or pro-Putin to say we want to make sure that, you know, this aid is being delivered responsibly.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as long as people recognize that there's always going to be more spillage, if you will, when we're on tight time constraints. Yeah. It's just the nature of that sort of thing. But yeah, So any other thoughts? Do you have any sense that, I mean, do you think 3 months from now we'll be talking about this?
I do.
Yeah, me too, sadly.
And that's simply because Putin doesn't have a good way out. And you know, nor do the Ukrainians really, right?
No.
They have to, you know, keep fighting for their country or die, essentially. And I don't think Putin's got the military power to actually take over and occupy the country, at least in the near term, particularly given that the weapons that we're providing.
And I would say even in the long term, it's difficult because as long as sanctions remain more or less intact, his ability to do those sort of things and build a military and keep it built up that becomes increasingly difficult. And especially given the fact that China has not been nearly as supportive of Russia as Russia would like. I mean, they certainly have been supportive rhetorically, and they've talked a lot about illegal sanctions and so forth, but they're not doing the sort of things Russia wants them to do that would basically allow them to circumvent those sanctions because, you know, China's acting in China's own interests, right? So so that makes it hard for Russia. And I really think, I want to be optimistic at this point. I think as long as we can just maintain our will, I think in the long term, the balance of resources and initiative will shifts or stays with the West, and eventually Putin will lose this war as long as we don't lose faith, lose hope, and stop supporting Ukraine.
Yep.
So there you go. All right. Let's move on to a domestic story. Early this week, the Supreme Court halted implementation of a Texas law that allows both the state and as well as individual Texans to sue social media companies if they ban, block, remove content, or otherwise discriminate against posts made by individuals based on their viewpoint or geographic location. The law, which Governor Greg Abbott signed in September, is a response to that belief among many conservatives that platforms like Facebook and Twitter are targeting conservatives and removing their content specifically. Now, the law,
I believe it.
Well, but you can believe it. Now, the research says otherwise, but anyway, believing it or not, the law was initially blocked by a federal district court, and then I think the surprise of a lot of people in the legal community, the Fifth Circuit lifted the injunction on that law. And so then it went on the so-called shadow docket to the Supreme Court. Five justices voted to reinstate that district court injunction or overrule the Fifth Circuit. They were an interesting combination: Roberts, Breyer, Sotomayor, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Now, they didn't give a reason for their action, but that's not really unusual in these emergency requests.
Right.
Now, on the opposition side, we have another unusual configuration. We have the court's three most conservative justices, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, joined by Kagan. And Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch join onto this opinion saying that, well, they haven't decided, written by Alito, saying they haven't decided on the constitutionality of the law. And given the fact, especially, that most of the court's precedents here came in the pre-social media era, and in Alito's words, Texas should not be required to seek preclearance from the federal courts. And that seems so Alito-esque. But anyway, so you might wonder how Kagan fits in. And my take, and I think the take of a lot of court watchers, is that, well, it doesn't have anything to do with that. It's more with her general distaste of the emergency requests and the shadow docket. She's not a big fan. She's been very clear about that, and she doesn't like the court to act on those things. So now, kind of adding to this, late last month, the 11th Circuit ruled that much of Florida's very similar law violates the First Amendment. And this was a three-judge panel, all of them Republican appointees. The author was, in fact, a Trump appointee. They wrote, "We hold that it's substantially likely that social media companies, even the biggest ones, are private actors whose rights the First Amendment protects, and that the law unconstitutionally burdens that First Amendment right." And kind of the basic argument for these laws is that the big social media companies have become, in essence, common carriers. And as such, they have to provide service to all customers on an equal basis, though they still do have the right to ban certain categories of content, like, for instance, pornography would be the one that would most jump to mind, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And then this also, though, intersects with Section 230 of the Federal Communications Decency Act, which gives providers liability protection for, in the words of the act, any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. So, Jay, I wanted to get your take both on whether or not the Supreme Court was right to put this on the shadow docket and rule the way they did, as well as kind of your thinking about what might have been behind the Fifth Circuit, because they didn't issue any kind of explanation, as well as the larger issue we could get into of the constitutionality of the Texas as well as the Florida law.
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, this is sort of a tough one in that, as you point out, in these kinds of emergency motion decisions, you don't always get an opinion or a big explanation. And sometimes the sense is, obviously, on injunctions that, you know, you have to show irreparable harm and immediate irreparable harm. Now, typically, a constitutional violation is going to constitute that type of harm. So I can understand where a court's going to, a court could say, look, we think there's certainly a chance for constitutional harm in balancing the equities on an injunction. You know, we're looking at what's the harm on the other side. Probably not so much if we allow this, or if we grant this restriction and essentially allow everything to remain the status quo. So I think there's some of that thinking going on there, right? That we shouldn't make these big constitutional decisions hastily, and so, I guess I'm not sure I want to read too much into it, based on, you know, what, again, what a lot of the judges,
right? Because we're not talking
said
about the merits.
Look,
here,
we need, this is a big question. We need to take a harder look at it, and there's no to the extent that there is a potential constitutional harm, it is immediate, and we can allow that to be enjoined while we, work this out.
Right, which is basically what the majority on the court, I mean, yeah, we could assume that they were thinking. Certainly, we know that the district court and the 11th Circuit felt that way, right? And it seems to me that Alito's argument, along with Thomas and Gorsuch, is that yes, this is a big issue, but before we rule on it, we're going to sort of defer to the states, essentially, with that preclearance remark.
Yeah, well, so the preclearance comment, and this is why I'm a little bit of two minds on this, because there is also a pretty firmly established principle out there that in the law, not just out there, but that legislative acts are presumed to be constitutional. And in fact, they're presumed to be constitutional unless shown unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. And that can be a pretty high hurdle to get over. And I can sympathize with the the senators there in saying that you shouldn't have to get that kind of preclearance, that you should have that presumption of constitutionality. But I think the status quo argument just sort of carries more momentum, right?
The
idea is once a constitutional injury occurs, it's occurred, and then it's you can't undo it.
I think especially given the fact that this could take quite a bit of time to work its way through the entire court system. And so this would be, I mean, and to me also just on the merits, this seems to me to be so patently, obviously a violation of the First Amendment. I would think anyone who has an ounce of libertarian blood in their body would just look at this and scream, oh my God, the state, look at what an awful thing the state is doing, right? I mean, and so this doesn't even really seem close to me. The common carrier argument seems to me to be just ridiculous. I don't throw around the – anyway, I was going to throw around the word fascism. I won't. I'll withdraw it. But anyway, I can't believe – it's just – go ahead.
So, no, I would – so I think the common carrier argument is intriguing. I don't know that what this bill does supports that. You know what I mean? The common carrier argument is – sort of like this, that look, you have your phone service or the mail service, and I could call you up on the phone and I could say whatever the hell I want to you. And the phone company, because it is simply a common carrier and just delivers the messages, is not going to have any editorial control over what I say or don't say. It's really none of their business. So the question is that the way that these large social media companies are working? Is that how they operate? Are they more like the phone company or are they more like a newspaper? A newspaper is something that, you know, you can submit letters to the editor and the editor can determine whether or not to publish them and determine what stories to publish and what not to. And in exercising that editorial judgment, newspapers and those types of media companies are open for claims of libel or other defamation,
which is where the CDA comes in, right? I mean, because that seems to me, and this hasn't even been discussed. I'm sure it will, you know, in the district court when this comes to the court and they're looking at it. But I mean, that seems to me, as I read Section 230. That seems to me to be a pretty clear grant of liability protection from exactly the sort of lawsuits that Texas and Florida are authorizing. And so it seems to me that if the Supremacy Clause means anything and the plain wording of Section 230 means anything, then that's an independent grounds of just dismissing this thing out of hand.
Maybe yes, maybe no. And okay. Again, I think that's one of those, because it's a complicated question, right? That's why you don't shoot from the hip on it.
Sure.
By my reading, Section 230, what it protects is it protects a social media company from being treated as a publisher, which is a little different than allowing them to necessarily censor content.
Well, let me. Let me just say, under C2 of 230, it says no provider or user of an interactive computer service, which these social media companies would fall right under that based on the definition section, shall be held liable on account of, there's a whole list of things, or otherwise objectionable content, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. So, yeah. I mean, to me, that's basically blanket liability protection. And I think I
differ with how you're reading.
Okay.
It. And I should have it pulled up in front of me. I should carry a pocket Section 230. Like people,
it would be helpful for this podcast, I swear. Yeah.
But the reason that it does it, because the way liability works, defamation law works, is if you are exercising that editorial control, saying this is not going to be in my paper and this is.
Right.
That makes you a publisher, and that puts you on the hook for the type of defamation liability.
Absent Section 230. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, and then, and keep in mind that the reason Section 230 was written, this was in 1996, when everyone was getting CD discs from AOL.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
no, it is a different world.
Kids don't remember that, but you would get like two or three of them a week.
Yep.
From AOL, and the scary thing of these big platforms, and because there wasn't social media, what there was these message boards, right? And any knucklehead, much like social media, could write whatever they want on any message board. And these companies were rightfully concerned that they had no way to really control or edit what was being written. It wasn't necessarily a matter of they wanted to censor. Rather, they didn't have the ability to do it just because of the sheer volume and because of the technology. And therefore, they shouldn't be held liable. Like someone you know who's running a newspaper would be.
But now but
I think that's the different argument, the argument that Section 230 is not intended to.
Sure. Well, and yeah,
censorship, right? It's to protect against the kind of claims that censorship would expose you to otherwise.
Yeah. I see. I think you're right in terms of the spirit of it. But of course, when it says that anything that the provider or user considers right. to be any of these things, that's the, maybe it was overly broadly written, but you know, it is what it is. But even granting that, and even if I granted those, it's saying that those other two things, that they are common carriers and that we don't have to worry about Section 230, there's still the inconvenient fact that every single person who signs up for a Twitter account or a Facebook account or what have you signs an agreement. Now, whether they read it or not, that's a whole different thing, right? But that's a contract. And as part of that agreement, part of that contract, they agree to certain terms of use. And if they violate those terms, they agree that service can boot them out. So,
yeah, no, and fair enough. But then you get into another question of, is that contract actually being enforced, and are what they are being accused or are being booted off of internet actual abuses or violations, right? When you have a standard that is so amorphous and can change from day to day, I think you could make the argument that that's sort of a contract of adhesion, that you have no choice, no voice in it. And it's to some extent, any right you're giving up, it's sort of illusory, right?
I guess I would say that none of these claims made by Texas or Florida or the people who are supporting these laws are utterly 100% ridiculous. But I will say that everything taken together, along with the fact that supposedly, conservatives are these great champions of free speech and the marketplace of ideas, just gives me the overall feeling that here are a bunch of whiny sore losers who want to enlist the power of the state to demand that private enterprises do their bidding. And I just find that so intensely distasteful and just fundamentally wrong.
I guess I don't see it as private enterprise doing their bidding.
Well, right?
If the company sells itself to you as, hi, we're here to provide you with a platform where you can say anything you want, again, within certain objective boundaries,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think we can say even things like that are difficult to define, like violence or pornography or something like that, you can still have some objective sort of criteria. Something like disinformation, I don't think you can have that same sort of objective criteria, right? If someone says, look, we're banning you because you're posting porn, well, okay. Most people can get an idea of what that is.
Well, there's a gray area there too, though.
There's a gray area, right. But it's not the idea of we're banning you because you posted disinformation, which it can tend to mean anything we disagree with.
Well, no, I think that's just wrong on the facts of what we know. It's not like people wake up one day and they're gone. It's there are warnings. There are, you know, there are oftentimes repeated warnings saying you have to have this many strikes and we will let you know. Yeah. You're informed of this. So it's not like some sort of.
So every day I get up and I tweet, the virus started in a lab in China. And I get a warning and I come back the next day and I still think the virus started in the lab in China. And I tweet that again and I get another warning. And eventually you get removed because you know, the Chinese government has determined that that is disinformation. And that's the definition, you know, and because the Chinese government has determined it's disinformation, then the World Health Organization has also adopted that determination. And as has our government. And therefore, if the government says it's wrong, it must be wrong. So you're out.
But there are certain things that are wrong that are just sure. disinformation. Right?
Sure.
So I guess
my response is, and so what?
I guess my response is, so we're saying that the government should prevent these companies from making these private enterprises, right, that aren't receiving. It's not like they're saying, well, if you want to continue receiving government funding or anything like that, it's just saying that, well, we're just going to allow you to be sued into the ground.
Well, there's a little more to that argument. I could share with you some letters from certain senators to Facebook. It's all very public.
Sure.
Where they you know, send letters, or they, you know, you can watch the hearings where they call people in front of Congress and sort of indicate that you better clean up your act here.
Right. And that's why, I mean, that's why I would expect you to be, that's what I'm saying, because there have been plenty of occasions, right, on this show where you've made the sort of, hey, yeah, nice business you got
exactly,
there. It'd be a shame
yeah.
if something happened to it. It seems to me this is doing more than that. It's this saying like, hey, nice business you had there, but we don't like it. And damn it, I'm Ron DeSantis, and I don't care if you're Disney or Facebook. I'm going to run you into the ground or the Rays. I'm going to deny your, you know, stadium funding because you're not towing the political line we want you to tow, and screw you.
No, I would disagree with that. But if you're saying we will allow people who have been booted to have their day in court as to whether you booted them fairly or unfairly, I think that's a different.
That's a different story. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't object to people challenging, saying, well, I signed this user agreement and it said yeah. these sort of things would happen, right? But this is different than that. This is in addition to that, right? And so that's where I, and certainly, you know, plenty of times on this show, I've argued that Section 230 of the CDA needs to be rewritten, and these folks are publishers, and so I get that. It just, like I said, the general, I used the word fascism, and I shouldn't have just done that sleazy kind of attorney-esque thing of throwing it out there and withdrawing it so it would just be out there, because everyone has watched it, you know.
I'm not going to say my yeah, opponent's a fascist.
Exactly, you know, but that
brown
word,
shirt fits, yeah.
But you can understand why some people would see this as perhaps the beginning of a slippery slope of the state sort of doing this kind of thing, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah, no, and look, I am not crazy about... So often, I think that conservatives make the mistake that something they don't like is fixable by legislation, right? Or
right.
fix it, or bad government is fixable by more government. No, that's kind of the
Yeah,
right?
that's not traditional conservatism,
yeah.
certainly. Yeah,
and so that often troubles me that a lot of times you have, and look, I can see this in a lot of different places, whether it's, you know, bathroom bills and all that sort of thing, or, you know, that you're sort of, just because the government may have screwed something up doesn't mean the government can now fix it.
Yeah.
Or that there's a social problem that the government can fix, that the whole point of a conservative, at least my brand of conservatism, is that there are a whole lot of problems out there that the government can't fix. And when the government wanders into it, they end up making things worse. So I'm sympathetic to that position of is this something that the government now, like I said, if we're talking about opening these, you know, places up for. Now again, whether a state can do that because of 230, I think that's obviously there's an issue there.
Right.
So
So how do you expect this to play out? I mean, my sense is that these laws aren't going to hold up, but I don't really think that Abbott and DeSantis expected them to hold up, but they did them anyway because they knew they would be very popular with a certain segment of the electorate.
So here's, and let me share something. This is a case that I'm actually involved with. There's a book written by Jeff Sutton, who's the Chief Justice of Chief Judge of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and a very smart guy. And I've had the privilege to meet him a number of times and talk with him. And I actually sort of had an intern lunch with him when he was the state solicitor of Ohio.
Because these are the circles Jay travels in.
These are the people
I
hang with. No, actually, in reality, I hang with people who hang with them.
Okay, there you go.
I'm sort of like a second tier kind of hanger on.
Gotcha. So,
I'm like Robin at the meeting of the Justice League.
There you go.
Right?
Okay. I'm the guy who knows Robin. All right. Yeah.
Batman. He wrote this book called 51 Imperfect Solutions, where it talks about state constitutional rights and how so often they are overlooked. And you have a lot of state constitutions that grant rights that are broader than what's in the federal constitution. And in a lot of ways, state constitutions have led the way in creating what became recognized federal rights. And one instance is, so there's a case out of California called Prunyard. And Prunyard had to do with leafletting at a mall. Labor leafletting. Anyway, the idea was the California Supreme Court said, look, you don't have to have government action to have a freedom of speech claim because the California Constitution is broader than what's in the First Amendment. And as are a lot of state constitutions, for example, the First Amendment is all stated in the negative of Congress shall make no law. A significant majority, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it's like 38, 40 some states have language that say, citizens shall have a right to speak freely. And courts like California for one, Pennsylvania is another, have opinions where their state Supreme Court have said, yeah, this is broader than the First Amendment.
Right.
And this means that, look, you can even have a free speech claim against a private entity.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
So I think there's an interesting play there that there might be. That was a really long lead up to say there might be a state constitutional claim that you could make.
We'd have
now,
to know.
Again,
yeah.
Even
about,
that
yeah.
state constitutional claim would still, because of the supremacy clause.
Right.
If 230 trumps it does. But I just wanted to point that out, that there's another way to look at this, that these states could have a legitimate state constitutional claim if their corollary to the First Amendment is as broad as a lot of states are.
Interesting. So how do you, given that we don't know that, because at least I don't know what's
right.
in Texas.
Well, it's not gotten that far.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether anybody pled the state court stuff in this
right.
suit to raise those issues, which again in Sutton's book and in his speeches always says he just doesn't get why people don't raise these state constitutional issues more often.
Right. But, well, that is an interesting perspective and one that I had not seen in all of
I bet I could get Judge Sutton on the show at some point.
That would be very.
I'll
cool.
see what I can do.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you have a sense though? Just that aside, which we don't know about. Did you have a sense of whether you expect this to be the sort of thing that ends up being upheld, or just don't know enough to really say?
I'd say don't know enough to say at this point.
Okay. I as usual, I'm going to be the one that I don't even feel this is a limb. I feel like I'm still on the trunk here when I say that these laws are eventually going to be held to be unconstitutional or in violation of the CDA or in some way will not be allowed to ever go
right.
into effect. So, all right. It'll be a while probably before we actually know that for sure, but I am sure we will talk about it when that eventually is ruled on.
We're agreeing on a lot of stuff today.
Well, you know, it's weird.
Yeah, I think I'm more agreeable on a Friday afternoon than a Saturday morning.
that could be. Here's something that maybe we'll have a little less agreement on. I don't know. We'll see. Just over 3 years ago, then Attorney General William Barr announced that he had launched a review into the origins of the FBI investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, specifically allegations of the Trump campaign's interaction with Russians. And then in October of 2020, he named U.S. Attorney at the time, John Durham, special counsel to lead that investigation. Now, Durham's ongoing investigation has resulted in the conviction of an FBI attorney who admitted to altering an email used to obtain surveillance warrants against a low-level Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page. It's also led to two indictments for making false statements to the FBI. One was against Russia national Igor Danchenko, who currently is, I believe, living in Virginia, who was a source for the notorious Steele dossier, as well as Democratic attorney Michael Sussman. And this week, a federal jury acquitted Sussman of making false statements to the FBI. Now, Durham alleged that Sussman falsely told the FBI that he was not coming to them on behalf of any client when he was, in fact, working with the Clinton campaign on pushing this story. Now, it seems clear, I think, to anyone who looks at this, that Sussman absolutely was trying to get media outlets to write about alleged Trump-Russia ties before he went to the FBI. I think it also seems reasonable to assume that he approached the Bureau in the hope that this would result in media coverage. But that's not the same as demonstrating beyond a reasonable doubt that Sussman actually lied to the FBI in that specific way, as the count alleges.
Yeah.
And the jury, in this case, unanimously voted to acquit him of making false statements. So before we kind of get into broader implications of the Durham investigation, what do you think about that sort of my summation of that? Is there anything you'd add or disagree with?
I think it's pretty correct. Although I would have highlighted, just for the color commentary, the first conviction, then the altering the email was changing the word, essentially saying that someone is working with the CIA to is not.
Yeah, it's pretty big off. Yeah.
It wasn't fixing a typo.
Yeah.
It wasn't a slight alteration.
It was a material alteration that made a big difference.
Yeah, essentially saying, hey, here's one of the good guys who's working for us, to saying, hey, here's someone who may be spying for Russia.
Yeah, it seems to me, correct me if you think I'm wrong here, that in general, when any of these big federal investigations, when all we see them coming out with, and this investigation is not over with, right? But when we see an investigation and the best that they seem to be able to come out with is making false statements, that they don't necessarily have a lot of meat, and they're just kind of going for something that's, you know what I'm saying here? Like, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of there, at least legally, which is different to say that there wasn't something going on.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And look, I would agree with you also that the indictment, what he was charged with was lying in person, in an in-person meeting, to the FBI, saying that he was not here on behalf of, not there on behalf of Hillary Clinton. He was just a patriotic American and thought this was something that his buddies at the FBI really ought to know about, despite the fact that he also billed Hillary Clinton for it, which is another story. And there was a text message where he texted a senior official, the senior counsel at the FBI, saying, hey, mind if I stop over tomorrow? It's not on behalf of a client, but it is sensitive. Now, he wasn't charged with lying in that text. He was charged with lying in person. And I can understand how a jury could find that the government had not proven beyond a reasonable doubt that he lied during that conversation, because there were only two people in that conversation.
And you know, it seems to me that there's kind of two elements here, at least to my mind. Maybe there's three. There's probably eight, right? But one element is like, well, what does the law say about this? And can we find a specific statute that we can convict somebody on? That's one thing. It's another thing when you ask yourself, was there some hinky stuff going on? Those are two very different things. And it seems to me, I find it just about impossible to believe that the Clinton campaign and people working with and supportive of, even if they weren't directly being paid by the Clinton campaign, that they had this information, these allegations, true or not, that they would say, well, you know, we certainly can't do anything with this, right? Because that's what campaigns do.
Yeah.
You get something like that. If you're any campaign, say, hey, your opponent's working with an enemy of the a hostile power, you say, well, damn, that's good stuff. We're going to use that. How do we get that out there, right? That's just...
Well, this is going to be important in as the investigation goes on, is that Jaffe, who is the IT magnate who is involved in this, that, you know, some of this evidence was sort of created from whole cloth to support this contact between the Trump Organization and Alpha Bank in Russia, and that the Clinton administration, the Clinton campaign, knew it was false from the beginning. And I think that's going to be significant. And Clinton's former campaign manager, Robbie Mook, actually testified that, look, Clinton signed off on this. And that also the practice was this sort of circular reporting, which is, you know, the idea is you go and you tee it up with the FBI. And then you go to the media and say, hey, the FBI is looking at this, because that makes it newsworthy. If it's just press release from the campaign that, hey, Trump's a crook, well, that's not news.
Which is why Sussman would want to go to the FBI. I think then sources in the FBI tell us that.
And that's the same reason why all these other folks with the dossier going through the FBI, where Glenn Simpson's went through his wife, who works with or at the FBI. I mean, that all these connections. So I think Durham has done a great public service in connecting some of these dots. It's not done yet, but I think the bigger story is how the media was either duped or had enough of a suspension of disbelief.
You know, I want to talk about that element because it seems to me that. And I come at this obviously from the position of somebody who thinks that Donald Trump is a morally bankrupt, entirely corrupt individual, right? So that's going to obviously bias me. So if somebody tells me that somebody who I think is morally bankrupt and entirely corrupt is in bed with the Russians, I think, well, sure, okay, you know, if you said that to me about, I don't know, about, say, John Boehner or something like that, I'd probably say, I don't know, I'd need to see some, or, you know, or Jack Kemp, or, you know, or whatever, you know, somebody on the right who I, you know, used to, you know, like. So there's that. But I think if you're the FBI and somebody comes to you with any kind of what seems to be credible evidence, or even half, you know, suggestions that someone who may be the next president may be influenced by a hostile foreign power, you can't just say, well, that's too politically sensitive. We can't look at that, right?
Yeah.
But it's one thing, of course, to do
the
that.
The fact that they did look at it and they found nothing.
Well, yeah, but I mean, some of the deeper conspiracy stuff is saying that what the FBI did is they knew that this stuff, they had good reason to believe that this was all just BS, and they actually almost encouraged it because they're part of the deep state against Trump.
Yes.
And that's where that, to me, kind of goes off into tinfoil hat sort of land.
No, I wouldn't say tinfoil hat there, because if you look at all these various connections, and Kim Strassel had a great piece in the Wall Street Journal that she's really been the person on more on top of this than anyone else in the country, sort of connecting a lot of these dots. But just the weirdness, right, of why this wasn't taken through normal channels, the fact that the regular FBI guys, not the political FBI guys, you know, looked at this and said, no, there's nothing there. And that the FBI, some members of the FBI, the senior leadership, sort of wanted to be lied to, if you will, right? It sort of lets them off the hook saying, well, hey, here's a guy, a respected lawyer who's not working for any campaign. He just came here on his own because he felt a patriotic duty to let us know about this. So, gosh, we needed to take a look at it. And again, the Clinton campaign doesn't necessarily need an FBI investigation of Donald Trump or doesn't need the FBI to indict or convict him. What she needs is a hook to give to the media to say there's something here. And it works both ways. Of course, in the Carter Page case, one of the things the government alleged was, hey, judge, we know this is true because we've seen it reported in the news, right, which they planted.
Yeah, that's sure.
And that's the circular reporting thing.
Yeah,
right?
And I should point out that both sides.
And Mike, I think I told you, I've had, you know, local politics stuff, went a big blow up years ago. And what this one group of people would do is they would make complaints to the police saying, I'm being harassed by so-and-so. And the police just take the complaints, right? This is just they're not going to arrest anybody. It's a procedure where you just file a citizen's complaint saying, sure, hey, I want to let you know I'm, you know, whatever, my neighbor's playing his music too loud, that kind of thing. So what they would do is saying, I'm being harassed and I believe I'm being harassed and stalked by this person. Then which the local newspaper in tandem with these same folks would make a public records request. And then they would report police investigating X.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's you know, this is just kind of the way a game has been played. And it's dirty and it's silly when it's at local politics, but it's really ugly and dirty when it's the FBI.
And let's not forget that people on the left have plenty of reason to be upset about the FBI in 2016 when Director Comey comes out and decides he's going to talk about an investigation of, which is normally something and you don't mention, but hey, by the way, the Democratic presidential candidate, we're investigating her use of personal emails. Like, wait a second. And she had every right to be highly pissed at that, right? Because that's incredibly. So I guess what the left and the right can agree with on this is that the FBI did anything but cover themselves with glory when it comes to the 2016 election.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And so that's
you know, something I think you and I probably agree a whole lot on, that there is a very unfortunate and maybe a little scary trend in criminalizing politics.
Yeah.
And I think that's,
which,
you know,
is why, really, yeah, which is why I think it's good that President Biden made no even attempts, if rhetorically or otherwise, to shut down investigation, right, to shut down this investigation, which I think for all the reasons you talked about, and just in general for legitimacy and transparency, is incredibly important that that it go forward and that Durham be given a free hand and allowed to, you know, lead wherever the dots connect, right? And I don't think that that's going
to. And to me, to my mind, it doesn't necessarily have to end in a conviction of someone or another, right?
Yeah.
What's more important is the finding out what happened.
Exactly, because I don't think it's going to end in any high profile convictions. Yeah. I'd be pretty.
And there may not be a statute, nor should there be,
right,
a statute to convict someone of political dirty tricks.
Yeah, I,
right. The remedy should be at the ballot box.
You know, I think in general that the FBI in particular, but the justice system in general just wasn't set up to sort of deal with these sort of things, right?
No, and so they're supposed to like catch drug dealers,
yeah, exactly,
and smugglers,
you know.
So the federal,
And so that's when you have an organization doing a job it wasn't intended to do, it shouldn't be surprising that it does it badly. So there you go. All right. I guess we did agree on that. Well, on that note of agreement, well, if you are a Politics Guys supporter, the rest of the episode is coming right up. We're going to talk about the Tulsa shooting and a very unusual position I'm going to take, at least hypothetically, on guns, the Herd Depp trial and some big issues about, well, free speech and the Me Too movement, that firing of the Princeton professor, Joshua Katz, and some issues about, well, political correctness, wokeness, free speech, and so forth, and maybe a little bit more, we will see. If you are not a Patreon supporter and you'd like to hear all that every week, just go to Patreon.com/politicsguys and you can get all set up, or you can also support us on Venmo. We're at Politics Guys as well as through PayPal. All the support links are in our show notes and at politicsguys.com/support. And if you're not in a position where you can afford to support us, the show financially, but if you'd like to hear everything we're putting out there, just email me, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will be happy to take care of that for you. And whether you're a supporter or not, it really helps us out if you can subscribe to the show, rate it, and whatever podcast app you're on, leave a review, and also share episodes on social media. Thank you very much.